I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is going to be a fascinating hour. I am sure of that. Our guest is the author of a piece that's in the current issue of National Geographic, The Science of Death. And she writes about so much. She starts her piece, The Crossing, with a story of a toddler, Gardel Martin, who fell into an icy stream in March of 2013. He was dead for more than an hour and a half, but 3.5 days later, he left a hospital alive and well. His story is one of many, prompting scientists to question the very meaning of death. She writes a very moving story about Carla Perez, who has a massive stroke and she is pregnant. And so the ragged border between life and death, with a brain that's ceased functioning and would never recover, but a body that could be sustained mechanically so that the fetus growing inside her could ultimately have a life. It's fascinating. She looks at trauma teams conducting clinical trials on gunshot and stabbing victims, having their body temperature lowered in order to stop bleeding long enough for surgeons to close up their wounds. There is a Wisconsin connection here. As you know, at the University of Wisconsin, there has been long time studying of monks in meditative states. And it turns out that some of these monks, after they die, the body doesn't decompose sometimes for as long as a week. And so what state are they in? Is there still a consciousness? Well, we're talking about that and much more with the author of the piece, Robert Moranz Henning, is with us. And Robin has written some very interesting things. She wrote a piece in 2010, What's It About 20-somethings, in the New York Times Magazine, where she's a contributing writer. And then it was a book, 20-something, Why Do Young Adults Seem Stuck? Her book before that was Pandora's Baby, about the early days of in vitro fertilization. And she's written many other things as well. So, the science of death this hour of the program with Robin. Hello, Robin. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. My pleasure.
This must have been absolutely fascinating to write about.
It was, and slightly depressing, but generally, in a way, kind of upbeat to think that death can be reconceived as something that's not necessarily permanent.
Yeah. When we think about it, and this is a small part of the story, but I do want to start with Linda Chamberlain, who's co-founder of this cryonics company, and she had her husband frozen, whose last words were a point, you know, if you can get humor out of this. Gee, honey, I hope this works.
Yeah. She plans to do cryonics herself also. And, you know, in theory, they would both be defrosted at the same time. I don't know how that works.
Yeah. And who knows what they're going to encounter or when that might happen. Imagine walking into a world 1,000 years from now.
I know. That one is the one that's sort of the freakiest to me and the hardest to wrap my mind around. You know, some of these other examples that you described are much more grounded in the here and now.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's tell the story. There are a couple that are so poignant of this toddler who really was dead for more than an hour and a half. It's just an amazing story.
Right, it is. He was out playing with his older brothers in Pennsylvania, near a stream, and he fell into the stream. It was very cold. It was like March, the first decent day of the spring. And the little boys ran back to the house to tell their mother they couldn't find him. The toddler, the Gardel, went down the stream a little bit further, and a neighbor pulled him out, but he wasn't breathing. And within minutes, they got emergency medical people out there and who tried to do CPR, and they just could not get his heart beating again. They kept doing CPR. They did it on the ambulance to the hospital. They did it in the helicopter en route to a bigger hospital. They just could not get the heart to start beating. And the doctors who were dealing with him knew that because his body temperature had gone down so much, that's the situation in which he stood the best chance of coming back without any ill effect if they could bring him back.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what kept them doing it. Because when your body temperature goes really, really far down, which is what happened from this frozen stream, everything kind of slows down. All your metabolism slows down, and your brain doesn't need as much oxygen. Everything is sort of focused just on your heart. And the rest of your body kind of goes into a sort of suspended animation. That's what saved Gardell, because when they finally could start his heart up again, finally after all of this CPR, it finally took, it's CPR and at the same time also trying to slowly, very slowly, rewarm his body. Because his body temperature had been so low, there were no ill effects in the end.
That's amazing.
His brain was just fine. Yeah.
And he was getting ready for surgery for cardiopulmonary bypass, a most aggressive form, you write, of active rewarming. Did they have to do that, or did he come to before that?
They never had to do that.
Amazing.
I mean, that would have been really major, you know, opening up his chest, putting him on a heart-lung machine, just whatever they could do to bring him back. And there were times, along the way, the doctors would look at each other and say, it's been 85 minutes, it's been 95 minutes, should we stop? And they just, there was something about this situation that just made them keep going. Mm-hmm. If he had fallen into warm water, if that's what his drowning had come from, they would have stopped much sooner.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Because they knew that this was the situation where they could bring him back and he wouldn't be damaged.
Huh. And also in the case of Carla Perez, the doctors and the nurses and the staff kept going with her. Her story is amazing as well.
Yeah, I found her story really quite touching and complicated because, the stroke that you alluded to left her brain dead.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole concept of what brain death is so hard for people to understand. And so the doctors kept, working to keep her body functioning. So that it could sustain the fetus, who didn't seem to have any damage as a result of her stroke or her brain death. So they just wanted to keep the body making this baby grow. But at the same time, they were also kind of still thinking of her as a presence in the bed, which you can kind of understand. She looks alive, even though her brain is not functioning, and the only thing that's keeping the body going is that it's attached to all sorts of machinery.
Mm-hmm.
So it just sort of creates this very difficult, that's the real gray zone between life and death, I think. Because according to, the strict definition of death, she died in February when her stroke happened. But they were able to keep the body functioning until April.
Amazing.
And when the baby was then born. And so they think of her as dying in April, the day after the birth. Because that's when they finally took everything, all the machinery away. So I don't know, what's the real story? Did she die in February or did she die in April?
Right. And the baby was small, but the baby was fine.
The baby was fine, yes. He had no ill effects.
Hmm. The other story, and I know it's being investigated by a gentleman we've had on the show before at the University of Wisconsin who's been studying monks in meditation for years and years. I didn't know this, though, that he came upon a monk who he wasn't sure if he had died or not. It looked like he was just in deep meditation, but he was dead. But the bodies do not decompose for more than a week.
Yeah, right. And
what's
not
that?
Only does it not decompose, but in some cases it seems as though they're actually sitting up.
Oh, my goodness.
This is Richie Davidson, who is doing a lot of research now in India, trying to figure out what's going on with these monks. It's hard to know how to study them because it's a rare situation, and the ideal would be to be able to do some brainwave testing before the monk actually dies to understand if what happened is he was in some sort of really deep meditation and at some level, his brain function is still working at some very, low meditation-like state while his heart has stopped.
Hmm.
And it's hard to know, and I think Davidson doesn't really know. That's why he's doing this research. We were hoping to be able to get out to India when one of these things happens and take photographs, and, that's what Geographic loves to do.
Right.
And have me be there to watch this happening. And it just never worked out because it's one of those things that's really hard to predict. You
right.
You don't know when a monk is going to go into this state called sukdam.
Right.
It was just sort of a random, bad luck thing that we just weren't able to do it.
Yeah.
But I'm very intrigued about what he might find out.
Well, he'll take a picture of some kind and you can do an update, right? We could do
maybe
another story.
Yeah.
That would be,
or you can have him on your show. I'm sure he does come to you a lot.
Yeah, we will. As a matter of fact, that'll be interesting. So there's so much in the article. Baltimore and Pittsburgh, trauma teams conducting clinical trials, gunshot and stabbing victims having their body temperatures lowered in order to slow bleeding long enough for surgeons to close up their wounds. Is this significantly cooling it down, and has this never been done before, or what?
Well, they've never done it at quite that low level. I think they intend to cool it down to like about 50 degrees.
Whoa.
Normal body temperature is 98. I'm not sure if it's exactly 50. But one of the difficulties in doing this study, and this is what they're just starting to do now, is when a trauma victim comes into the emergency room bleeding out, basically, and probably unconscious, he can't actually give you informed consent to be part of your clinical trial. The way their ethical review boards in their hospitals have constructed it is that they can get some sort of a blanket community-wide theoretical permission to do this kind of a study. So they've had to spend a lot of time doing community education about what their intention is, and let people kind of opt out if they want to, to actually say, if I come into your ER and I've been shot or stabbed, I don't want you to do that to me. So there's just a lot of hurdles to get through before this kind of research actually can get done, just because of how difficult it is to do a study on somebody who's unconscious and you're doing something that's really dramatic. I mean, in a way, you're putting them into the situation that little Gardel was in. You know, you're in effect making them dead so that you can save their lives.
Ooh, my.
Yeah.
Another one, Life and Death, you write, is all about motion. There's a doctor, Dr. Roth, in biology, the less something moves, the longer it tends to live. Seeds and spores can have lifespans of hundreds of thousands of years, practically immortal. That's something to think about. He imagines a day when using iodide, which is in early clinical trials in Australia, can give people that immortality for a moment. It's the moment they most need when their heart is in serious trouble. What's that one? What's iodide?
Well, you know, the thing that would happen with iodide is much the same as what would happen by lowering body temperature. It would also severely slow down everything that happens in your body and put you into kind of a state of suspended animation for the same reason. You know, like when your heart stops and they bring you into a cath lab and try to revive you and reoxygenate you, apparently the introduction of oxygen is sometimes the source of the damage. It's something that they call reperfusion injury, because your body has started to shut down, and if you sort of blow it all out with oxygen, it sort of has done something that's protective, and then the oxygen disrupts what it had done to try to protect itself. So this iodide would actually lower the oxygen need of the body, especially the brain, and so when you're able to then reintroduce oxygen at a much slower level, and so you don't actually do damage to the organs. That's what the intention is. It's a way to help people recover from cardiac arrest, from having their heart stop, in a way that isn't damaging.
Fascinating. Another part of the article looks at people who have thought that they were dead, and, you know, they're going to a dome, they're seeing, I'm wondering, and we hear stories about this, they've been struck by lightning, and they're paralyzed, they're supposedly dead, but they are revived, and they're living again. And there are some pictures of those people in the article and stories about them as well. What did you learn about this, you know, borderline between life and death from those who technically had been dead? And what kind of dead had they been? Was it brain dead, or was it another kind of dead?
Well, they were heart dead.
Okay.
You know, their heart had stopped and for a protracted period. And these people say that when they came back, you know, when the resuscitation worked, they remembered an experience that sounds like what we think of when we say a near-death experience. You know, they remembered a bright light and a feeling of peace and a disinclination to go back to the real world, you know, not even really wanting to be revived because everything is just so beautiful. And you hear these stories a lot, and it's hard. You know, I'm a science journalist, so I have a pretty heavy skeptical level. Mm-hmm. So do scientists. And so there are some scientists led by this guy Sam Parnia in New York who are trying to figure out what's really happening. If those experiences really happened, if they're just sort of remembering something that maybe happened as they were coming back, if that feeling and memory is actually just a direct result of the loss of oxygen to their brain and nothing else. So they're trying very hard to figure out what those near-death experiences really mean and if they're telling us anything about what it's like to be in that limbo between life and death.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, the gentleman who was on the phone to his mother and he was struck by lightning and
yeah.
he felt that that music became his purpose, that people have a renewed sense of purpose, and he came back and composed music, or what did he do?
Yeah, and played the piano
right.
magnificently when he hadn't been able to before.
Goodness.
Yeah, a lot of people do get a renewed sense of purpose. I mean, whatever happens, you know, physiologically, certainly happens in a way that's really emotionally important to a lot of people. And so when they interpret it as, whether this is true or not, when they interpret it as, I almost died, I saw the light, I came back, they see this as a reason to keep going and you know, sort of a message to take to other people. Like one person I talked to who had a very profound near-death experience, then came back and ended up working in hospice with people who are dying because she felt like she was able to make them less afraid because mm-hmm. she had been there.
Yeah. Let's go back to Carla Perez for a moment, the one who suffered the massive stroke and was pregnant. So she's brain dead, but the other organs in the body kept going for how long? And because the brain is so tied to the other organs, how mm-hmm. could those organs even function without the brain connection?
Well, the organs can't function without the brain orchestrating it. So what needed to happen was there was a staff of like 100 people
oh,
who
my
worked
goodness.
On her over, you know, round the clock over the course of those 54 days she was kept alive. And they had to basically do all of the sort of, you know, overriding orchestration of all of her organs because the brain couldn't do it. So they had to keep measuring, you know, all of her organs' functions. They had to make sure that her circulation was working. You know, they had to do all of the things that the brain will do to keep a body functioning. Her heart was beating without help, and that's just because it's a muscle that just sort of does that. It sometimes will even beat in a petri dish. But nothing else was really working without machinery or IVs or a whole bunch of stuff, you know, being done to her. Because the brain couldn't take control over it. So they were like an artificial brain.
Remarkable. And then there reached a point where some of the dead brain cells got in the blood and the baby had to come out then?
Well, when the first time the dead brain cells got in the bloodstream, it was kind of a crisis, and they got very worried and thought the baby would have to come out.
Right.
But that crisis resolved because they were just sort of able to, I guess, push a lot more of, you know, fluids into her, or I'm not sure what the issue was exactly, but they were able to keep things going for another 2 or 3 weeks, and then they realized that it was getting very close to the time when they couldn't recover from something like that anymore, and so they just delivered the baby.
Mm. Remarkable.
But by then he was pretty close to term, but he weighed less than 3 pounds. He was quite small, but he was perfectly normal. It's amazing.
What a story he's going to have, right?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
My gosh.
Well, I loved having that story to tell because, you know, I was writing about this borderline between life and death. And what I loved about it is that somebody who was living in that borderline for quite some time had, you know, new life come out of it at the other end.
Yes, absolutely. So if you knew that these advances in resuscitation, which look like they're inevitable and who knows how quickly they may arrive, if you knew that there were going to be huge advances made within the next 100 years, mm-hmm. Robin, would you mm-hmm. freeze yourself?
Would I freeze myself?
Yeah.
No. I don't think I would. And actually, what a lot of people are doing in cryonics now is they're just freezing the brain because that's cheaper and takes less space.
Oh, my gosh.
And the cryonics company will charge you less. And so what is brought back then is, well, you know, in a way, maybe that's better. What's brought back is the brain itself and all of the connections that have, you know, turned this into a brain that is essentially you as opposed to somebody else. I don't know. Maybe I'd like that better than having my 65-year-old body come back, you know? I don't know. But no, I do feel like it's really a long shot at this point.
Right.
I love to read science fiction about it, but I don't think that I would do it. I thought where you were going was another question that did also occur to me, which is when I find out how long resuscitation can go on for and how, if it's done right, there can be a good result. You know, even if you keep doing it for like an hour, there can be a good result. It hasn't made a difference yet, but it did give me pause about my own, like, do not resuscitate orders.
Oh, fascinating.
Because, you know, I have those orders because I keep reading about how rare it is for somebody to actually recover from CPR. You know, that it's not the way it looks on medical TV shows, that most people don't get out of the ICU if they've been resuscitated. But this new group of, you know, like really high-end resuscitation scientists are saying otherwise.
Yeah. Well, it also depends on the care that you have, right? Because these doctors and nurses and staff spend a lot mm-hmm. of time with these patients. Most
yes.
hospitals probably can't do that.
Right, right. It's becoming more common to in the emergency room to at least lower the body temperature somewhat, because that does improve the odds. But I don't know how common it is to keep going, you know, because you really, a lot of doctors are still sort of taught that you have, you know, 7 minutes before the brain starts having damage from lack of oxygen. And so after about 10 or 15, a lot of teams will say, we can't, it's not working. But there's a cohort of doctors who say we should keep going.
Mm.
And I don't know what the convention is.
Right.
Right now. And as you say, it's very hard to know because hospitals vary so much.
Yeah. Oh, Robin, I feel like I'm being lifted right off this earth as we continue this conversation. It's really, and you must have been really lifted way off this earth. This hour of the program, Robin Marantz Hennig is our guest. She's a journalist, an author, and a science writer. She wrote a book with her daughter, 20-something, Why Do Young Adults Seem Stuck? She's also the author of Pandora's Baby. She has been awarded a Guggenheim Foundation Fellowship, a pair of Science in Society Awards from the National Association of Science Writers. She's adjunct professor at NYU School of Journalism and came to our attention most recently because of this fascinating piece that she wrote, The Science of Death, Coming Back from the Beyond, which is in the current issue of National Geographic. So, want to join us? I think some of you may want to. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We are on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. We're talking about this borderline between life and death, and she tells some remarkable stories of people who are brain dead but have been able, because of the intervention of medical teams, to carry a fetus to term. We're talking about those who whose hearts have stopped and yet, after a long period of time, have been resuscitated. We're talking about monks who appear as though they're in deep meditation. They have died, but there is no decomposition of the body, sometimes for over a week. It's a fascinating article. All right, lots of calls coming in. I thought there would be. We'll be with you momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls as we look at the borderline between life and death and the many aspects of that. Todd in Green Bay is our first caller for you. Hi, Todd.
Hello.
Hi, Todd. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just had a quick question for your guest. I remember reading a study a while back, and it touched on that the moment you die, there's some chemicals that flood the brain, and that's why they believe that people, as they die, were seeing the white light or having the wonderful feelings and all that sort. And I was wondering if your guest in her research touched on that at all.
Yes, actually I have. I mean, the people who are a little bit skeptical about what a near-death experience really is say that. They say that the lack of oxygen or the flooding of other chemicals into the brain at the moment of death might be responsible for this. In fact, one guy who I quoted in the article thinks that it might be something called REM intrusion, you know, almost a kind of sleep state that's not exactly a dream but like a dream. So that's why Sam Parnia and his colleagues are doing this kind of research, because it's still up in the air. It's still really hard to know what might account for these visions. And so many of them are so much the same. They're so much like each other that's, you know, that's really a source of interest, too.
Yes. And Parnia said, you say this toward the end of the article, believes we're still in the Kitty Hawk era when it comes to reversing death. What does he say about how many advances will be made, how many clinical studies are going on now that's going to really change this whole area?
Well, he's a big person who pushes a lot for lowering body temperature and perfecting the CPR technique, you know, making sure that you do it at exactly the right pace and do your compression at exactly the right level. And so he feels like in not very long we're going to be able to bring people back from what we think of as death much more reliably. You know, he's very big on talking about temporary death versus permanent death. He says that when your breathing stops, a lot of your organs are still alive. So if there's, you know, they take a much longer time, the cells in your body take a much longer time to actually shut down altogether. So it's during that period that he thinks that resuscitation can really make a big difference. And, you know, I think he's pretty optimistic about it. You know, I think he probably thinks it won't be more than 10 years from now that we have different, you know, statistics about how likely it is to revive people.
Thanks, Todd, for your call. Celeste in Madison, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to just add to the conversation. I tuned in right around the time that your guest was talking about keeping a mother alive to sustain the fetus, and I was involved in a situation in Madison as a nurse several years ago now, but we were actually able to keep mom alive. She had stroked at home in an outlying area, actually, and had to be transported. And we were able to keep her on life support for, gosh, I'm sorry, I could be wrong, but I want to say close to 2 months. So
wow.
We could get the baby past viability, actually. And the baby was delivered without complications, and the father still keeps in touch with us. And the daughter is doing quite well.
That's amazing. I love those stories.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so how you were a nurse on that case, is that what you're saying? So do you remember how complicated it was to keep that body functioning?
It was insane. I was a labor and delivery nurse, and we monitored the baby 24/7 because we would have taken the baby by crash cesarean if necessary. So we monitored that baby for months. And the ICU nurses and doctors worked relentlessly to keep everything in balance. Things that I don't understand as a labor and delivery nurse, but the baby was just so resilient, and the respect that mom was treated with was also so impressive. Even though technically she was brain dead, we spoke to her. We let her know how her baby was doing. We, you know, washed her hair, braided her hair. Her family came, and it was a terrible experience, yet an honor to be a part of it.
I'll bet it was. And Carla was treated in the story that you read about in National Geographic the same way. People spoke to her and treated her as though she
was
still there.
And they also cleaned her hair and painted her nails. I think that, it's a beautiful thing to do, and it's a very humane thing to do and respectful, as your caller said. But it also complicates your understanding of what's going on. You know, I mean, that's what's so tragic about cases of brain death. and especially so when it's a pregnant woman.
Thank you so much, Celeste, for your call. Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello. It's a great program. My mother, when I was a year and a half old, she had a disease called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, where your heart just becomes too big. And she was a big-hearted woman, but she was on the operating table, and they couldn't get her heart started again, and someone was hand-massaging it for some minutes. My father says 45 minutes, and they went upstairs to work on another woman, and then they called them back down and said, hey, it's started up again. And so by this miracle of science, I got to know my mother. She lived another 15 years, mm-hmm. and I think that with this question of science versus whether you want to call it folklore or a spiritual perspective, kind of misses the point. I don't think it's an either-or. I think every one of us will find ourselves at some point prostrate on a bed and unable to do much about it. And there's a certain humbleness, and I think a certain beauty, in some of these stories of something gentle taking care of you, if it's taking care of you for those last few minutes or if it's taking you somewhere else. I think there's really something to be said for, hey, I've got this possibility ahead of me, and that's kind of beautiful.
Mm. Oh, what a great call, Carl. Thanks. Robin.
Yeah, thank you. That's a beautiful way to think of it. And mm-hmm. and I think a lot of these men and women of science who I spoke to had that feeling, too. I mean, I think that's what made so many of them so interesting to interview, because they knew with their heads that one thing was going on, but they were driven by their hearts to try to see whether something was happening that they couldn't really explain. I really appreciate you phrasing it that way.
Yes. Thank you, Carl. We go to Annie in La Crosse. Hi, Annie.
Hi. You're all going to hate me now that these wonderful stories, but I just wonder, how many people can we keep alive, and how many people have to die? Who's going to pay for all this? We are so afraid of death in this society.
That's a legitimate question, Robin.
Yeah, it is. It is it's a very good question, and I think that's why I still have my DNR, because we do have to die at a certain point, and even when, even when we're making it more likely that a higher percentage of people can maybe be resuscitated without damage, it's still a low percent. And, you know, working really hard to try to keep everybody alive no matter what does turn into a questionable goal for the sake of money, but also for the sake of, for some people, it's only going to get worse and worse. You know, if they're very
yes.
sick and very frail and very old,
mm-hmm.
You're bringing them back for just more of this. You know, many of the people who I found to use in the article were younger and healthier, basically, and those are the ones who are the happier stories. But you're right; it does sort of reflect the fact that we're so afraid of death that we don't even want to. You know, we want to sort of stop it no matter what. I think that's what happens with cryonics. You know, the person is actually has died, but there's still this tiny, tiny bit of hope sitting there for like $80,000. I mean, it's really incredibly expensive.
Is it $80,000? It's $80,000.
Yeah, I think so. Or that might just be the head. I forget.
Oh, gee.
I mean, it probably varies somewhat.
Oh. Well, we don't have the ethical guidelines with all of this, do we? We haven't informed people at hospitals what to do or doctors what to do about this. Isn't it relatively
right.
new territory?
Yeah, and partly because we are so afraid to talk about it that we're not really upfront with people about what their options are.
Thank you, Annie, so much for your call. Bill in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Hi, Bill.
Hello, do I got a hold of yours?
You got a hold of us, sir. Go right ahead.
Okay. I 2 years ago, I had a blood clot in my lungs, and they I flew out to San Diego, and they put me, they cooled my body temperature down to 50-some degrees, and when they got ready to operate, they shut me down. My heart was stopped for a total of 12 2 minutes on one cycle. They took the blood clot out of my lungs, and 25 minutes on the other side for a total of 47 minutes.
Whoa.
I flatlined.
Really?
And did you come back with any experiences that you remembered?
Nothing. They had me doped up pretty good. I didn't remember too much of any experiences other than by a couple months later, I was looking on Facebook and they were showing me a picture that of a guy that had died on the cross. And they says, the caption underneath of it was, Jesus died for your sins. And what went through my mind was, well, of course he did, but what happened to this guy? it was a short deal that this only lasted a second or two, but it just seemed strange to me that I would even think something like that.
Yeah. Were you aware when you had the blood clot? Were you conscious in everything or not?
When I got the blood clots, it took a while for them to decide what they were going to do with me. They tried other medications and stuff.
Right.
So I live in Chippewa Falls.
Yeah.
They flew me out to San Diego.
Wow.
And I was awake through all that, and they told me what was going to happen to me.
Uh-huh. So were you surprised to wake up from it, or did you think you might be gone?
Well, the doctors had more confidence in that I won't have any problem, but it scared me pretty good.
Well, I can see. Yeah. Was that kind of an advanced thing to do, Robin, at that time, a couple of years ago?
In operating rooms, they have been doing this for a while. When they do this also for brain aneurysms. You know, when they want to sort of cut off a clot one place or another, they might actually stop the circulation altogether by lowering the body temperature and then rerouting things through a heart-lung machine. So it's not new, but it's high-tech and risky.
Right.
So 47 minutes of the heart being totally stopped is a long time. And that is an example, if you want to think of it this way, as being brought back from the dead.
Right, it is. You're in a rare category, Bill. Thank you so much for your call. Brian in Fond du Lac, hi.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Good, Brian. You?
Great. I've been doing a lot of research lately on CRISPR gene editing and the potentiality for extended human life, and I understand now that in some of the editing practices, they've extended the life expectancy of mice up to 3 years, and which is phenomenal. Are you still there?
Oh, we're here.
Okay. And what happened was, I just wonder what the potentiality is that your guest has heard about in terms of CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing telomerase extensions.
Yeah, I haven't studied CRISPR for that. Well, I don't know that much about CRISPR, just a little, and I haven't paid any attention to it being used for that purpose, for sort of inserting a longevity gene, or I can't really speak to that. But it's another question that you want to ask of, do we really want to like double everybody's life?
Right.
And are we increasing a lifespan of a healthy life or of a sick life? That runs up against a lot of very difficult policy questions and ethical questions.
Mm-hmm. What made you do this article? Did you hear a story about someone, or was it just on your radar?
I seem to have death as my beat recently.
Oh, do you?
I mean, I've been doing a lot of articles on sort of end of life decision making. Like if you, I wrote an article about a woman who had a diagnosis of dementia, of Alzheimer's disease, and she wanted to end her life before she became completely demented, and how complicated it was for her to make that decision. And I wrote another article about somebody who was paralyzed from the neck down, who wanted to stay alive, and his wife had to figure out how to interpret his desires. And so this was almost like a natural next thing. I've written about hospice care also. Mm-hmm. It is just that I feel like the decisions we make at the end of life and the way we approach death are huge issues and will become more so as my baby boomer generation approaches that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll take more phone calls in a moment. Thank you so much, Brian, for your call. Our guest this hour is the author of a piece that's in the current April issue of National Geographic. The Science of Death, Coming Back from the Beyond. Robin Marantz Hennick is our guest. She's a journalist and author and a science writer. She writes for the New York Times Magazine. She writes for National Geographic. She writes for a number of publications. And she is the author, with her daughter actually, of 20-something, Why Do Young Adults Seem Stuck? She's also author of, well, a number of other books, also Pandora's Baby, about the early days of in vitro fertilization research. Two more of your phone calls at 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We are on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls for Robin. Let's go to Mandy in Waupaca. Hi, Mandy.
Hi. I heard a program on Wisconsin Public Radio about a year ago where there was a report that most doctors do not want to be resuscitated because they know that there are so many negative outcomes. And I can see a younger person who still, you know, has children to raise, and they have that responsibility, be doing that. But I'm 74, and I've told my family, and I've written it down, that if my heart stops, do not resuscitate, I want to go to heaven.
And so our conversation hasn't changed your mind about that?
No.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But you're right that when you poll doctors, they are much more likely to say, I don't want to be resuscitated, because they do see how often it can go wrong, even in pretty, you know, high-end emergency rooms or ICUs. You know, it's especially when it's somebody who's old and sick, the odds are that it won't end happily.
Yeah. Thanks, Mandy, so much for your call. Deacon in Sheboygan, hi.
Hi. Great program. It's very interesting. I have a question. I think it's a simple one, but probably not. You said that a lot of the organs continue after supposed death occurs. What causes the breathing to stop? Is there a reason for that, or is it a compound thing that hasn't been figured out?
Well, it seems to kind of be a compound thing. And when Parnia talks about the organs, continuing, he kind of will look at the cells themselves in a body that's been dead for a while and see that the cells are still dividing. But as far as the cardiopulmonary system, you know, because they're all interconnected, the breathing part and the heart beating part are all connected. If the heart stops beating, then the lung stops doing its thing as well. There's any of a number of things that could make the heart stop beating, usually something like a heart attack.
Thanks, Deacon, for your call. Dave in Madison, hi.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to make two comments. When I was in my 20s, I'm 62 now, we were laying pipes, water pipes, at a school, and I was working underground, and I was electrocuted from when a wire hit the backhoe, and I was holding onto a steel cable standing in water because it's hot out. I fell face down in the water, and it was a total out-of-body experience where I was above, and you know, you're looking at everything. But when I came back to, I remember when I first opened my eyes, it felt like I had blinders on, because prior to that, you were aware of everything that was going on 360 degrees around you. There was absolutely no sound. And for years, people, you weren't really dead. But I was electrocuted so bad that on every bone where your joints come together, I had big burns where the electricity had arced between your bones. And I had no doubt that I had died and I had come back, but maybe 7 years, 8 years after that, my brother was killed in a car accident. It was prior to cell phones, and I was following him, but I was about 2 hours from behind, coming from Chicago to up by Wisconsin Dells. But anyhow, when I hit the point where my brother had died about 3 hours prior to that, I started shaking real bad, so bad I had to pull over on the side of the road. I didn't know what was wrong, but I felt like someone was there trying to contact me. It was a real strange experience. And then when I got to my parents' house, I found out that is where my brother died just a few hours before. And at his wake 3 days later, I remember he did try to contact me. When people think that there isn't, you know, something that goes on after death, are sorely mistaken, because it was just like he was trying to talk to me. And it only lasted a few seconds, and then it was gone. But it wasn't something I imagined, and it wasn't something that, you know, was influenced by me, because it only lasted a short time, and if it would have been me, I would have brought it up way before or when it bothered me the most. But those are the two comments that, you know, my, right. you know, death experience, and then my brother actually passing away and trying to contact me.
Yeah, thank you, Dave.
Do you feel like your experience a few years earlier might have made you more sensitive to your brother?
They were connected at all. You know, my experience, like I said, I was totally out. I wasn't trying to, you know, contact anybody. Where my, you know, it was a few minutes where I'm face down in the water. Where for my brother, it was hours after he passed away, and there was nothing where they even took him to the hospital. He was pronounced dead at the scene of the accident, and then it was days later when he tried contacting me again. I don't think they were related at all. I actually think he was trying to contact me. And from my experience, I actually think that something goes on after death. I don't know how long it goes on or what happens, but it doesn't end, you know, when the heart stops beating is what I've come to the conclusion. And I don't want him to continue my life. I mean, the last thing, my mom's 91, and she wants to pass away. Her mind's still worse, but her body's shot. And you know, they keep him alive in nursing homes. And you know, to keep her alive to 93, 94, 95, I think that isn't what she wants. And I couldn't imagine a fate worse.
Robin.
Yeah. Well, it also sounds like your experience with your near death and with your brother's death makes you a little bit less afraid of whatever awaits you next.
Yes.
Is that right?
I didn't understand what you just asked me.
It sounds like you're not afraid of dying for real.
No. It's something goes on afterwards. I'm not afraid. In fact, what I'm afraid of is just the opposite. It's being kept alive like my mother is now, where she doesn't want to stay alive. You know, her mind's still good, but, you know, her body's shot, and she's going to be 91 in just a few weeks here. And if she lives to be 95 or 96, it's not what she wants. And to keep someone, you know, ongoing, you know, everybody wants to stay live longer when you're young. You know what I mean? Living longer at 90, you know, isn't what you want.
Right. Thank you, Dave.
And when people talk about longevity, I think they forget that. They think that they can sort of extend the best part of
exactly.
a life. And I don't know that always works out that way.
Yeah. Ben in Kenosha, getting short on time. Hi, Ben.
Yes, good afternoon. I just wanted to offer sort of a traditional Jewish perspective in this discussion that's probably a little bit different. I mean, this concern about money kind of disturbs me a great deal because, you know, from this perspective, a person can fulfill their religious obligations and many others only in life. And so my hope is that people who have this kind of approach would be respected as far as having a decision involving their clergy, the medical and scientific, as well as family in a holistic way, such that perspective is not obliterated. I've had to, unfortunately, see sort of the quality of life orientation that many in the medical field have that in some ways tends not to respect that holistic approach, which could admit to a decision to DNR, but also might admit to a decision which keeps someone longer than perhaps the medical or scientific authorities would find appropriate, as well as certain Jewish law definitions that have to do with what is the definition of death and things like that. So in the end, I'm hoping that in considering these matters, that the holistic view that is encompassing those things is what takes place.
Thank you, Ben, very much. And we'll give you the final word on this because we are out of time. Robin, it's a fascinating article. I can't wait to see what you write about next.
Okay.
You know, but let us know, please.
Okay, I will.
Thanks so much.
Okay, pleasure, Kathleen.
Robin Moran's Hennig. Her piece is in the current issue of National Geographic and has prompted a really fascinating hour here. The Science of Death, Coming Back from the Beyond. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers for finding this piece and for producing this hour, and also to Scotty for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Tomorrow, the new initiative to find alien life in our universe, Breakthrough Starshot, the blessing and financial backing of Stephen Hawking and Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. A pair of astrophysicists will be joining us tomorrow during this hour. Thanks for listening. Thanks for all of your calls. News is coming up from NPR.